pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you so much. And I think we go to Jody is going to do a presentation.
Yes, Madam Chair. Item C is, I'll do the quick intro. It's the workshop, so it'll be a little informal. I've got staff on the front row, but a number of you have expressed interest in receiving a refresher course on Robert's Rules of Order. So we asked General Counsel with FMPA, Jody Finkley, to come up, and he's going to give it his best shot to give you a very, very high level refresher course with the understanding that if you have any additional questions outside of the Q&A, we'll get you Jody's contact information. You can reach out to him at any time. We're also going to order the board this Robert's Rules of Order in brief pocketbook for y'all, just for reference. Letitia's probably going to try to get that ordered sometime this week, okay? And with that, I'll turn it over to Jody. Jody, thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Brian. And thank you, Grant. I was thrilled when Grant called and said y'all wanted to spend 4 or 5 hours talking about Robert.
And we're happy you brought dinner.
So here's what this slide deck does. And I just wanted to let you know that the slide deck in main part is for your reference later. I won't attempt to go through all the details in here, but you can use it later as a cheat sheet. A little insight, a little history of Robert's Rules of Order. Review the conduct of a meeting and the making of motions. Review the method for making nominations from the floor and holding an election, because that's something that's covered by Robert's Rules of Order. And then going over a meeting process and providing a little bit of practical advice. So, you know, Robert's Rules of Order is parliamentary law, and parliamentary law, which like six people in the country actually care about, is the rules for how to conduct a meeting. And it's not an official statutory law. It doesn't have a legal effect unless you adopt it. But once you've adopted it, there are rules that you follow. And particularly what Robert's Rules does is it handles the making of motions so that you can take action as a body, the discussion of those motions and the debate of those items, and then how to vote. That's what Robert's Rules does. That's what parliamentary law does. So here he is, General Henry Martin Robert. You won't be surprised looking at the length of a book on how to hold a meeting that he was an Army general. You know, in the Army, they have a way, instruction manual for everything, including how to go to the restroom. He was also an engineer, which also explains a lot. And he was the country. And he was also the country's leading parliamentarian. And what he did as a general for the Army, and he was in the Army Corps of Engineers, is that he would go around the country and he would attend meetings everywhere, and he realized they were all held in a different way, and everybody had their different practice. And he said, this is ridiculous. We should have one way of doing it. So in 1876, he adopted his first Robert's Rules of Order, and today we're on the 11th edition. Here's what they do. Robert's Rules protect the right of the majority to make decisions, the right of the minority to be heard, the right of an individual member to have his or her say, and the right of absentees. So it's entirely designed to make the meeting effective, protect the ability of the majority to make a decision, but also protect the ability of those in the minority to have a say. But other rules still control. Sunshine law, statutory requirements, your charter requirements, those still control. Roberts doesn't overrule any of those. There is a lot of formality in Robert's Rules of Order. For example, under Robert's Rules of Order, technically, no one's name should ever be used in a meeting, only their title. So it's not Jean or Kathleen, it's Madam Chair, or it's Madam Director, or whatever the title is. A lot of formality. The chair always refers to him or herself in the rules in the third person. So it's never, I'd like to have someone make a motion. It's like the chair will now entertain a motion. And you see this sometimes in the legislature. Under Robert's Rules of Order, technically, No one ever speaks or says a word unless the chair has recognized that person. So if I'm making a presentation and Ethel, you ask me a question, I can't answer. You can't ask me the question unless you've looked at Gene to get permission to ask me a question. Then I can't answer you without also.
The chair.
Yes, ma'am, the chair. I also can't answer the question without asking for permission to answer the question. So the point of this is don't get tied up in the rules and the formality. You can get overrun by the rules and the formality, but that's not necessary to preserve the intent and the purpose of the rules. So who runs a meeting? Well, it's the chair, the presiding officer. And the chair acts as the moderator of discussion, keeps track of the meeting, understands what the motions are that are before the body, gives the floor to members to speak. But the chair is also a judge, because under Robert's rules, there are points that can be raised to the chair that the chair has to decide on and determines procedural matters. And so for those purposes, for that purpose particularly, always good to have a good parliamentarian at your meetings, and you're blessed with a very good parliamentarian in Grant. So the chair runs the meeting. The order of business is the agenda. Under Robert's rules, you don't technically have to have an order of business. But if you adopt an order of business, if you start your meeting by having the board adopt an order of business or an agenda, then that agenda then has to be followed. If you don't adopt an agenda, then any member of the board can raise at any time that he or she has the floor any matter that they wish to have the board speak on. So if there's no adopted agenda, a vote and second on the agenda, it could be chaotic under Robert's rules. A quorum. So you have to have a chairperson. You have to have an order of business or an agenda. You have to have a quorum. A quorum is the number of your body that's required to take action. In most cases, it's a majority. I know of some cases where, you know, for example, in one of our cities, there's a 7-member city council, but they have to have 5 to hold to be a quorum. And under the Attorney General's opinions, a quorum must be physically present for local government. So you have to have a physical quorum within Kissimmee for your purposes. And if there's no quorum present, then no action can be taken. You have your chair, you got your order, you've got your quorum, now you're ready to have a debate. The debate is simply the discussion over the matters that the board is going to take action on. And under Robert's rules, no one has the floor to engage in the debate unless they're recognized by the chair. Under the rules as well, the chair should give the floor to the members in the order that they've asked for it, and no member is permitted to speak for more than 10 minutes unless the chair gives permission to go longer than that. The rules also provide that no member can speak more than one time, can't speak twice to the same issue unless permitted by the chair. But certainly the person should not be given a second opportunity to speak until everybody else who's wanted to speak in the first instance has been given the opportunity. And then all comments under the rules have to go to and through the chair. So if there's a motion made in a second and someone says, well, I think the motion is stupid and Mrs. Smith making that motion is just ridiculous, well, then that person is directing their debate, their discussion to Mrs. Smith. And really it should be, Madam Chair, I believe the motion is wrong for these reasons. So the debate is to and through the chair under the rules.
Can I back up for just a minute?
Yes, ma'am.
As far as attendance on the meeting, if we have a quorum here for a meeting, but we have a member that sometimes out of town and comes through the TV set, can they vote? I know that they can't count as a quorum, but can they vote as a member?
Yes, ma'am. They can vote as a member as long as there's a quorum physically present in
the
room.
That's what I thought. I just wanted to clear that up. Thank you.
You have to have the quorum physically present in the room, but the person, once the quorum is physically present, the person who is attending electronically
Better
can vote.
They were here. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So the meat of Robert's rules and what most of these pages deal with are motions. And there are a number of types of motions. And I can literally spend the next 6 hours describing motions for you, and all of you would be asleep. But I'm going to go over very quickly the 4 different types of motions and then I'm going to give you a quick breeze through the slide deck, which describes each of these, and I'll stop on a couple of them and describe them in a little more detail. But the first is the main motion. That's the one you're most familiar with. That's the one that does business. It's also, though, in the hierarchy under the rules, it's the lowest, has the lowest level of precedence. Then there are privilege motions, which deal with matters that are not connected to the main motion, but they're important matters that have to be dealt with right away. Then there are subsidiary and incidental motions, which are both connected to the main motion. So the main motion, like I said, is the lowest ranked motion that brings business before the board, has to be made and seconded. It can be made anytime no business is pending. So anytime someone has the floor and there's no other motion on the floor for consideration, the main motion can be made, has to be seconded. It is debatable. People can agree and disagree with the main motion. It's amendable. Voting is simply by a simple majority unless your charter requires otherwise, and it can be reconsidered. So you'll see this format. I have all the motions described using this format. When it can be made, must it be seconded, is it debatable, amendable, what's the vote, and is reconsideration possible? So here's how, under the rules, the debating the main motion is done. The member makes the motion, and under the rules, the chair then repeats the motion that is made before a second. The chair can be asked to assist the member in making the motion. So if there's a discussion or the member making the motion is not quite sure how to word it, the request can be to the chair, please help me word this motion, and then it's up to the chair with the help of the parliamentarian to word the motion to repeat it. Once the motion is repeated, the chair then asks, is there a second? If there's no second, then the motion fails. If there is a second, then the motion is up for debate. And the person who made the motion has the first opportunity to speak in favor of the motion. Then other members of the body are granted opportunities to speak. When everybody has had their say and the chair is convinced that there's no further debate, the vote is called for, and the body votes on the motion. So, stepping back real quick, the last point of the main motion, you'll see this on the standard format for all the motions, is it reconsiderable? And the answer is yes. There's a number of motions that can bring a question back before the body that have already been decided on. And these have the same low rank as main motions. And there's four different types of motions, which I'll describe very briefly, but reconsideration is one we'll stop on and just talk about for a minute. Once a motion is made, seconded, debated, and voted on, it can be reconsidered at the same meeting. So later in the same meeting, someone can say, you know what, that motion we made on item 3, I want to reconsider that. It can be made at any time, but only by a member who voted on the prevailing side. So if the motion was adopted, it has to be somebody who voted in favor. If it was defeated, it has to be somebody who voted against it. And it has to be at the same meeting. That motion to reconsider has to be seconded, and it's debatable only if the underlying subject of the motion is debatable, and we'll talk about that in a minute. It's not amendable. Not amendable. So once someone makes a motion to reconsider and there's a second given, it's not amendable. The vote is by majority, and it itself can't be reconsidered. Other motions like this to bring things back up that have already been discussed is to take from the table, to rescind, repeal, or annul, or amend something that's been previously adopted. This is just like a motion for reconsideration, except it's not limited to being done at the meeting where the action was taken. You could have adopted a policy a year ago, and now you can make a motion to rescind, amend, annul, repeal that policy you adopted a year ago. You'll see here, too, that that's a two-thirds majority requirement under the rules, and it's because it wasn't something that was dealt with at that same meeting. There's also a motion to discharge a committee, and we'll talk about committees briefly in a second. So those are the motions to bring back something before the body. So now we'll talk about privilege motions. These are unrelated to the main business. They relate to matters that are of particular importance and need to be decided right now, and these have a hierarchy. So you'll see I have numbers here, 1, 2, and we go on and on and on. But the reason there's numbers is that under the rules, these have to be dealt with in the hierarchy they're listed. So if you get, say, a motion to adjourn, which is in the hierarchy number 2, and then someone says, no, I don't want to adjourn, I want to do a motion to recess, number three, you have to take the motion to adjourn first because it has a higher priority in the hierarchy. So there can be a motion to fix the time to which to adjourn, a motion to adjourn itself, and these can get quite contested. I've seen city councils where debate gets very rancorous, and someone will just jump up and say, oh, I move we just adjourn the meeting. If that happens, first of all, it can be done if no one has the floor. If that happens, it has to be seconded. If it's seconded, it's not debatable, it's not amendable, and the vote's a simple majority. So once someone makes a motion to adjourn and it's been seconded, the chair's obligation is to hold a vote. And if the vote is yay, it's adopted and the meeting's adjourned. And it's not reconsiderable because now you're not in a meeting anymore. There's also a motion to recess and a motion or a raising a question of privilege. This happens quite a bit. You know, someone may have a question. It's not really a motion, but it's a question. Can we do this? I have a question on can we do this. That's a way of raising a question of privilege, and it's ruled on by the chair. This is a case where you'd want your parliamentarian to help you. And there's also a call for the orders of the day, which means, hey, chair, we've gotten off track on the agenda. Put us back on the agenda track. So those are the privilege motions. Then you have subsidiary motions. Most of these you've probably heard about or dealt with in some way. Lay on the table, and notice these have numbers as well because these are in the same hierarchy. If you want to simply set something aside to a later indeterminate date, address a previous question, which really means that you want to close the debate immediately and go ahead and vote. So someone who makes a motion to on the previous question says, let's quit yakking about it and let's vote. Limit or extend the times of debate, postpone to a certain time. Commit or refer to a committee. You always have the opportunity under the rules to create a committee to look at something that's particularly contentious and then refer the matter to the committee. Motion to amend and a motion to postpone. So really quickly, motion to amend. Any motion that's amendable, someone can say, I want to amend the motion. So someone makes a main motion to say, move approval of X. Well, I want to amend the motion to say move approval of X, but only with this condition. Well, that's then a motion to amend. It has to be voted on because it's higher of precedence than the main motion. It has to be voted on first, so you have to have a second. And then it's debatable if the underlying motion is debatable, and then it has to be voted on before the underlying motion is voted on. So then, if it's approved, then you go back to the motion as amended.
Jody, so you can't amend once you get that second motion. You have to vote on it, and if it fails, then you can bring it back, right?
That's correct.
The amended, what would have been the amendment? Okay.
That's correct. And if the amendment fails and you go to the main motion, it's unamended.
And real quick, one other thing, yeah. Jody, if the board decided to refer something to a committee, it's very possible that committee would have to be subject to sunshine.
Oh, absolutely. It would absolutely be subject to sunshine law because it would be standing in the stead of the board.
Right.
So motion to amend is a good segue to jump to the end of this. One of the most important rules, I think, under Robert's rules is where it says, and I quoted it in the last slide, that if you've been doing something for a long time and you have a practice of doing that, you can continue to do that. If you want to, you could adopt a special rule that supplements this big book, and you can make it an official rule, but you can follow your own practice. Unless someone contests that your practice conflicts with these rules, then the rules have to control. That means that if instead of going through the rigmarole of having an amendment and then having a motion in a second, and then it's a vote on the amendment, and then a vote on the motion as amended, and then having a second amendment, a third amendment, and all that kind of rigmarole. If someone says, I move X, and someone else says, well, I move X on the condition that, and we do this at FMPA all the time, the chair would say, well, then would the maker of the motion accept that the amendment, and the maker would say, yes, that's fine. I now make my motion X on the condition that, and would the seconder agree with that? The seconder says, yes, that's fine. So you can short-circuit the whole formal process to get to that same result. And if that's a practice you've always had, it's a practice you can enshrine. So real quickly, I won't go through any of these individually, but this last category of motions are incidental. There's no hierarchy. You can raise points of order. There can be an appeal. That's an incidental motion. So if the chair is asked to rule on something, point of order or other things that the chair is entitled to rule on, another member who thinks the chair has messed up the decision can ask for an appeal, and the board as a whole can overrule the chair's decision if there's a majority vote. You can always move to suspend the rules, but you'll see that's a two-thirds requirement. You can object to the consideration of the question, which really just gets rid of a pending motion because it's for some reason inappropriate. You can divide a question, which means the motion is really complicated and we want to make it several motions. You can move to make a written motion or a resolution be adopted in paragraph or by seriatim, which means you vote on each paragraph of it individually. You can divide the assembly, which literally means the ayes have it. The chair says the ayes have it. Someone says, well, I've moved to divide the assembly. That means all who voted in favor raise their hand, or all who voted in favor stand, and then you've divided the assembly, and you can actually count to see who voted in favor to make sure the chair got it right. So these are all incidental motions. Parliamentary inquiry, request for information. I'll let you take a look at those, and I've included those slides there in the event that you want to go through any of the particulars of that. So nominations. So the Roberts Rules covers nominations and elections. Here's how nominations work. The chair calls for nominations for a specified position. If the more than one position is up for vote, you take the positions one at a time. Nobody has to be recognized to make a nomination. There's no second needed for a nomination. Simply, someone calls out, I nominate so-and-so for this position. After each nomination is made, the chair repeats the nomination and asks if there's any additional nominations. That continues until the chair is satisfied that there are no additional nominations. At that point, then, the chair determines that the nominations are closed and it's time for a vote. If there's been no procedure adopted for the vote, there can be a motion made to fix the procedure for a vote. And in the rules, there's about eight different ways of voting in elections, including by secret ballot. But most of those are not allowed under the Sunshine Law, so you're really limited to two choices. One is via voce election, where the chair asks for a show of hands or yeas and nays on who votes for a particular nominee. The other is roll call, where you simply go around the table and you ask each member of the body how he or she votes for the position. As soon as a nominee, if there's multiple nominees, has received a majority, the chair declares the election over and says that nominee has been elected. If no nominee receives the majority of votes, you start the voting process over again. You keep the same nominees, but you start the voting process over again. And if there's only one nominee, the chair can take a voice vote or simply declare that that person has been elected by acclamation. So a few practical considerations. Like I said, don't get knotted up. There's a lot of formality here, and you can spend a lot of time thinking about orders of precedence and all that. But the intent is to conduct meetings so that the majority can take action and the minority has a right to participate meaningfully in the meeting. The rules, though, are important. And so you should always have a designated parliamentarian, which I assume in this case would be Grant, but you should always have someone who is thoughtful about the rules. And if there's a preferred way of handling something, consider adopting it as a special rule. And here's the language from Robert's Rules that allows you to enshrine your common practices in a special rule or says those common practices can continue to be used. You don't have to consult the rule book, 704 pages. Every time you want to think about doing something, if you have a adopted way of doing it, it's always been the way KUA has done it, you continue to do it that way. And so that is the presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions?
I've just got one, and it goes back to kind of the pros and cons of setting an agenda.
Yes, ma'am.
I know you do that at FMPA on yes, policymakers. That's always the first item of business, basically. What are the pros and cons? After you set the agenda, if something else comes up that somebody wants to have a vote on, how would you do that? Or would that be the next agenda when it was set? Or
Yeah. When FMPA did its governance changes in 2007, And there's someone here who I'd blame, I mean, give credit for that. Grant was the chair of the governance committee. But in 2007, we made the governance changes. We decided to have the bodies vote on an agenda to make sure we were following Robert's rules. The pros are that it gives everyone who's at the table an opportunity to say whether they like the agenda. And I'll just personalize this to FMPA for a moment. At the time we did that, there were some members of the board who thought that the staff was running the agenda process and that the members didn't have enough control over it. So that was a good way for us to say, look, if there's anything else you want on the agenda, tell us, please. So that's a pro. The con is that it makes it a little more formal. You start off with voting on the agenda, and it seems a little formal. It sort of sets the tone for the meeting. Another pro is that under the rules, if you have an adopted agenda like that, then there's a limited way to change it later. But that can also be a con, because the way you change it later then is you have to make a motion to reconsider adoption of the agenda. Once that's approved, then you go back to the setting of the agenda, and somebody can add or take something off. If you never adopt the agenda up front, then anybody at any time who's a member of the voting body can add or take something off. That's in their purview to make a motion to do that. So it's a practice that we ended up believing was the best practice for FMPA, because we have people come from all over the state, and we wanted to make sure that everyone at the meeting understood they had real control over what the business of the meeting was. It wasn't staff. In a local body where you're coming from a local area, and the people in the audience are coming from a local area, maybe a little bit of a different consideration. But still, under Robert's rules, it's still the preferred method.
Madam Chair, if I may, and I can tell you that with us in the City Commission, so we have an agenda that gets adopted. At the end of the meeting, we have here the city manager, city attorney, here the commissioners. There's been time that some commissioners have brought something up to the commission and requested to make a motion on the item. And it's really up to the commission if they even want to take a vote on it. Or some commissioners might say, this sounds like a good idea. We want to learn more. Mr. City Manager, can you put this in next agenda so we could have more information on the item? Or if it's something simple enough, of just something that's common sense, and we normally allow them to take votes on it, and we pass it.
And Madam Chair, along the same lines as the mayor just mentioned, we haven't yet done the process where we vote to set the agenda at the start of the meeting. We have had board members, sometimes at staff recommendations or board members' own recommendations, to respond to say, hey, we've got this issue. I would like the board to agree to add it to the agenda, and the board's done that. That's happened here. Not often, but it's happened a couple times.
I don't think we have a problem with being open and above putting things on the agenda here. At this point, if it becomes a problem, of course, we can always act. But I don't see changing it at this point. But by the way, I will remind you, none of you asked me if you could speak, and I did not give you permission.
Oh, I did, though.
I said Madam Chair.
I heard the mayor.
No, I said Madam Chair.
But I didn't say yes.
I've gone enough through this, Robert, that it's in here.
Director Abena.
Yes, ma'am.
No mentioning names. That's right. I just had a question on the nominations.
Yes, ma'am.
When you nominate someone, do you do it one title at a time, or can you do multiple titles in one nomination?
You do it one office at a time. So if you had a president and a vice president and a secretary that were going to be nominated at the same or voted on and elected at the same meeting, you would start first with just the president. All the nominations will be made for president. There's no limitation on any one person being nominated for multiple offices. So if Mrs. Smith is nominated for president but she doesn't get the presidency, or if she does and then she's nominated for secretary or treasurer, that's perfectly appropriate. And if the charter allows someone to serve in both roles, then she can be elected to both roles. But you do it one office at a time.
Thank you. Director.
Are there any other sunshine law issues other than how you conduct your vote?
The Sunshine Law has been interpreted to require that any member of the public attending know how every member votes so that they can understand how their representatives on the body have cast their vote. So you can't do, like, there's a whole section in here on secret ballots for elections. You can't do secret ballots because then the members of the public wouldn't know how everybody voted. You've got the quorum requirements. And you have to have a quorum under the Sunshine Law to take action, but of course you can have a Sunshine Law violation without a quorum. That's probably it, right? I don't know of anything else that jumps to mind immediately.
Well, we televise our meetings, so it's totally open to everybody to see what's going on and how everybody votes.
Yeah.
Correct?
Regular meetings.
Yes.
Regular meetings, right.
Yeah. There's one other thing. This... The rules here, if you really want to get some sleep and you read these carefully, you would see there's provisions for executive session and there's provisions for sidebars where people get together and discuss an issue on the side. Obviously, you can't do that under the Sunshine Law, although there are certain shade meeting allowances under the statutes for Sunshine Law. The Roberts Rules provisions on those sort of things would fall. In favor of the Sunshine Law.
Jody, can I ask you something? A long time ago, I have a small red book of Robert's Rules of Order. It's not that large.
Yeah.
Is there a condensed? Because I read that a long time ago.
Yes,
if we could all, something like
yes.
that.
Yeah, there's
mine's hard bound, but I think everybody should have that because
this is the uncondensed version with all the commentary.
Well,
that's the Cliff Notes version. Yes. I would strongly recommend you look at the commentary.
I think every one of us should have one of those. Because I know a long time ago I've had to have that information. I'm remembering a little bit of it, but it's important to know.
It is. It's important. If there's any other questions? If I could just close. Oh, yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
I had a question. I wanted to go back and just
sure.
essentially clarify. Like when we have a board member that comes in via Skype or some other mechanism because they're not physically present.
Right.
And they're allowed to vote. How come they're not allowed to be part of the quorum?
The Attorney General, this has never been dealt with by a court, but the Attorney General has gotten a number of questions on this, and they've issued opinions on this topic a number of times. And because the Sunshine Law is remedial, it's broadly interpreted to affect its purpose. And if the purpose of the Sunshine Law is to allow the public to see, to hear, to understand, and to participate in a discussion of local elected or appointed officials, then the Attorney General has said, well, in interpretation of that, you can have someone attend electronically, but if you don't have a quorum present, there's a barrier between the public who are attending and the people who are deciding. And we, the Attorney General's office, think that barrier is a violation of the Sunshine Law. So the person on the phone or on the Skype can vote if there's a quorum present, but there has to be a quorum present so that the people who are attending and who have the right to participate in the meeting can address directly in front of them individuals who are making the decisions. Now, FMPA and some other statewide organizations under statute are allowed to have meetings electronically, but that's because geographic dispersion. And several of the Attorney General opinions on this point have said that state agencies have that ability or larger organizations have that ability because they have members from all over the state. But this is particularly important for a locality, for the members of that body to be responsive and sitting in front of the people who live in that locality.
If I could ask a question, if it was coming in that way, would the chair not want to recognize that vote from that member since – not everybody could see it. So if the other board could say yay, and if the other person said yay also would say Director so-and-so also voted yay. So it should be announced also, not just assumed it.
That they heard?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. And if someone's...
To identify their vote.
Yes. If someone's participating remotely, electronically, they have to... Their vote has to be heard. Their commentary has to be able to be heard by everyone in the room. It's a little bit of an additional burden, though, on the chair as well to make sure that person is brought sort of virtually into the room, so to speak, and made a part of the discussion, and that everyone in the room can hear and see and understand what that person who's remotely participating has said and done.
Okay, because with the televised, that's almost more important. Because
it is. It is.
With the television, they wouldn't be able to see that television.
Yes. When was the last time they addressed this issue by the AG's office, or you say it hasn't been through the court? It hasn't, as far as
there's never been litigation on it, but a number of governing bodies have asked the question to the Attorney General's office, and the Attorney General, under our Constitution, has the authority to give opinions to governmental entities on how statutes affect them. And so when the question was asked, does the Sunshine Law permit for remote participation electronically by a governmental entity, then the Attorney General can issue an official legal opinion on Attorney General letterhead that addresses that issue to the governmental entity.
I'm trying to figure out when was the last time that was done.
Oh, when was the last?
Because with today's technology, I mean, we could have a person here with a on a screen that they'll see their emotions or what they're doing. It'll be just like being here, except it's going to be on a screen.
You know, I don't think it's come up recently. The last one I can think of, Manny, is 2014. It came up a lot in like the 2005 to 2010 time frame, I guess, when Skype and all those things really got going. There were a lot of cities who wanted to hold city commission meetings where everybody was virtual, no one was in a room, or they wanted to do city council votes by bulletin board or those kind of things. So there was a period of years where that got a lot of questions, and the Attorney General issued a lot of opinions. I think now everybody's following those opinions, and so there really hasn't been many questions on it in the last several years.
Because it works.
It works, yes, yes. And I will tell you, in Tallahassee, there was a PSC commissioner who was actually living out of state, and she attended all the meetings by remote access, and people got sort of aggravated by it. And so I think in just amongst the people in the know, so to speak, in state government in Tallahassee, I think they got the idea that it should be limited, but it can work. And you're right, the technology has advanced. It works better now than it did in 2010 or 2014, last time it was decided or opined on. But I think everybody's following the rules we have in place.
But then in the long run, if the person's out of town, they're not available for any of their constituents to call them and give them any comments. So therefore, that might limit their amount of access to the public if they're out of town. So that might, in a way.
Most of us have the same phone number, whether we're in town or out of town, so.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, neighbors coming out and talking to you. Like, I have a neighbor that's always talking to me. You know who it is.
Yep. Yes, I do.
He never calls me. I wish he would.
Well, I'll just close really quickly. I have a fantastic job. My job is fantastic because I have 31 great bosses. Larry is one of them. I work for the board. I work for you. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to provide you help. I'm happy to support Grant and Brian and your entire leadership team on what you do. Anything you need from me, I'm happy to provide. Thank you. And I hope I didn't put everybody to sleep.
You didn't, Jody, and thank you so much
for coming. Well done, Jody. Thank you. Thank you very much.
It was very well done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Hey, bye.
We are at
item D, Madam Chair. Again, this item, a number of board members indicated that they would like to see a revised, consolidated version of our board member orientation manual. I know Director Ortega provided some input, but certainly Director Hemphill. And Grant's has done a lot of work on this, and he's going to cover it high-level brief.
Thank you, Mr. President, Madam Chair, board members, and just real quick, thank you, Jody. That was outstanding, and I'm very fortunate, and we're all very fortunate to have Jody doing such a great job representing us at FNPA. So, yes, Brian appropriately gave kudos and credit to our board being proactive in getting this manual done. Director Hemphill, I believe it was last year's APPA National Conference, attended a governance seminar and came across some very excellent policies that some sister utility districts, Emerald People's Utility District in Colorado Springs, some governance policies that they had put into effect for their boards of directors. And Director Ortega had the idea that, hey, you know, especially not just new, but for all board members, but especially new board members, it would be helpful if we had a manual. It is a little bit thick, but if we had a manual, of course, you have the electronic version, where we can, you know, have questions answered at our fingertips. And so it's really the desire of staff for this manual to consist of material with which you're all very familiar. A lot of this is not new to you. But it would be a convenient resource that as questions come up, whether it's ethics or governance, you've got something at your fingertips that you can use during your service on the board. And I'm going to go through this. I know we got limited time. We got some good, we got some exciting pictures coming and a busy agenda at the board meeting. So I'm going to try to be as fast as I can. I'm going to go through our sections. And the first one, of course, is the preamble. Basically, that just sets forth the purpose of the manual. And the manual is for, really, the board is telling the world, we have expectations of ourselves as a policymaking body in terms of governance and in terms of accountability. And so that's what the preamble states. As an aside, I want to mention, you'll notice throughout the manual is about 20 pages, and then we have hundreds of pages of attachments. Much of that's the code of ethics for public officers and employees. But there are links that are designed to get you easy access to information that would be helpful. As an aside, I'm going to pass out tonight. We got some helpful pamphlets that are brief, much smaller than the manual, I might add, from the Commission on Ethics. And we just got those, and we'll be handling those out when for our next meeting. Just follow this. There's the introduction section, and basically that's just a general description of KUA's history. We're 118 years old. We have an illustrious history. It discusses our organizational structure and our place in the municipal electric industry. I borrowed heavily from Chris Gent's award-winning 2001 annual report, Generation for the Generations. We have a link in the manual. It's a fantastic read. So if you're interested in the history, I highly recommend taking a look at it. There's a reason it won a national award. It's amazing. Section 1 discusses the general board responsibilities. That sets forth you as board collectively, your general corporate and statutory duties at the policymaker level. It includes a description of your general powers delineated in the charter, such as adopting budgets, setting rates, issuing debt, adopting resolutions, and those kind of general powers. Section 2 is the KUA Board of Directors member conduct. This is several fold. First, we refer to the Code of Ethics for Public Officers and Employees. And yeah, it's a lot, but it does govern everything you do in terms of your role as an individual board member and being responsive to our ethical requirements, both as a board member and employees are subject to that as well in certain instances. Then it has the board establishing its own code of conduct relevant to your own individual expectations, not the state of Florida's expectations, but how you wish to operate as board members in terms of governing and in terms of ethics. The section also reviews for you, and this will be reviewed for you, financial disclosure requirements, gift reporting, board member orientation and training, travel expenditures, and identification of board members. We've attached, like the Commission on Ethics forms that you have to complete as a helpful resource to have it ready for you. And, of course, the goal of this section is to be a useful tool to refer to questions that come up fairly often. And don't ever forget you have me and you have staff. If the manual isn't getting you the answer, you always have somewhere to go. Section 3 is conduct of meetings, and thanks to Jody, I don't have to spend a lot of time on that today. But what we state, and this is important, is that the board is utilizing Robert's Rules of Order as a guideline. And you saw where Jody said, don't get trapped in the rules to the point that you can't act, that you can't govern. There are some practices we've had over the years that work, that are flexible. We don't have to abandon those. But Robert's Rules of Order is kind of the the goal of everything we do, that we want to always be mindful what Robert's Rules of Order say about a point of procedure, about how to move on something. But the board does reserve the discretion to adopt a different rule. And it really reserves that discretion at any time. But never to do it capriciously, never to do it arbitrarily. Try to stick with Robert's rules as much as you can. Section 4 is the Board of Directors and CEO collaboration expectations and evaluation process. I borrowed the most from these other utility districts for this section. They had some, I thought, was some really helpful language, just kind of clarifying policymaking versus operational. Clearly, the board and Brian worked together with staff to set the strategic direction of the organization. Brian is accountable for his performance and our performance, that we are operating in a way that's in our ratepayers' best interest. The board's role is to make sure that performance, that we are accountable to you, that performance is acceptable to our rate makers. And so we just kind of want to, you know, just lay out some parameters for operations and policymaking. Might clear up some areas that sometimes might get murky. I don't think it's happened very often, but it's just a design as a helpful roadmap. Section 5, succession planning. This is a brief section, but staff felt it was important to include this in the manual. Because by including it in the manual, the board is stating that strategic planning, effective strategic planning, is a policy goal, strategic goal of the board of directors. It's that important. It's important to the success and the continued operational viability of the utility that we have a strategic plan that is flexible and works in the event of an unexpected absence or vacancy. Section 6 is KUA sponsorships and use of KUA mailings. It's just simply summarizing what the eligibility requirements are for both applying for a sponsorship and using mailings from KUA. And finally, we have what's called the other appendices. Director Hemphill had mentioned that she thought the tax-exempt certificate, executive staff contact list, and the excellent FMPA value of public power that Jacob Williams had presented before, that it'd be helpful to have that added to the manual. And so that's why it's there. Really, the $64,000 question from staff is that, does this work for you? It's our hope that it will. It's not quite a finished product. We have a couple other suggestions about adding a technology section and making a more specific reference to the Rule of 13's requirement that there be a break in service after you've served a certain amount of time. But we're very eager to know if this works, if you're happy with it. We'd like to bring it back most likely next month for final board approval.
Are there any comments?
I kind of need to see the appendix.
The actual manual, yeah.
Sit down with it to before we vote on it.
We're not voting on it.
We're not voting on it. Yeah, I want to be clear. Thank you for that. Shame on me. We're not voting on it today. We just want direction. Yeah, I mean, if you said, we're not sure we need this, then we wouldn't bring it back.
Okay.
But
I get you.
But yeah, and really, it's our anticipation to take questions and suggestions over the next several weeks to make it as good as we can.
I think it's a very good idea. I think it's for anybody coming on board. It's a roadmap. It gives them direction. I was lucky enough that I had been around KUA long enough to kind of know since it was born, to kind of know what it was. But if I was coming on this cold, I don't think I would have. This would have been wonderful for me to have. And Ray, I think you've done us a favor by pushing this. I really do. Thank you so much.
I would, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would like to say thank you to both Grant and our president for the support and so forth, because I did give them a lot of stuff. I said, I've been collecting and creating my own, so that's why I just forwarded a whole list of stuff that I'd collected and said, see.
Hey, you're our researcher, so I know what you sent them.
She's good.
I'm sure they got every bit of information possible.
Well, actually, the technology thing, I had forgotten all about that, because to me it's a second nature because I've been in it my whole life. And consequently, I said, but I bet I'm the only one that even knows how to get on the Internet. So I suggested that we have a section on technology so that you understand what the passwords are and anything else that's technology-based.
Are you going
to... Well, even I know how to get on the Internet, so that, and I'm not...
Chair.
No, it's not Internet.
Madam Chair.
Intranet.
This one in here.
Are we going to have a page with all the alphabet soup of everyone that we deal with and the relationship between the different agencies?
The orientation package, which we have a link to that in the manual.
We'll have that.
We've got that online. Yes, sir.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Hearing that that there are an understanding that there are a lot of attachments, let's not, and knowing that Grant needs to incorporate the IT section, let's not bring this back in November. Allow y'all time to look at it in detail. Allow him time to put the IT. Why don't we shoot for December or January?
I think that's a good idea because this is an awful lot of information. And even though it looks very good to us, we may need to get into the weeds and see what it says.
All right, very, very good.
Everybody is okay with that, then probably January?
Perfect.
Sounds great.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Grant.
Thank you very much, Madam
Appreciate
Chair.
Everything, all this information we're getting. That's wonderful, actually. Oh, any other board discussion? Or are we going to...
Powder.
Do we have to have a motion Picture. To adjourn?
Yes, we do.
I would move that we adjourn.
Do I have a second?
I'll second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Meeting adjourned.
All right. Say cheese.